Welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, I'm introducing a new potentially monthly podcast, potentially weekly, if it goes well, breaking down the NBA. And it is a format that allows a wide variety of topics to be covered and thus a more inclusive environment for a wide swath of NBA fans. I'm joined today by Danny LaRue, who's going to be the guinea pig for this little experiment. Danny, how you doing?
I'm doing well, sir. Appropriate to be the guinea pig, considering I believe the first episode of Game Theory was the two of us just talking about stuff.
That's probably true. I think it's right. I think that's actually dead right, to be honest. I don't even think like the first episode of Game Theory is on this feed anymore. Like, I don't even think people can find it, because whenever I transferred from the good people over at CLNS over to The Athletic, I think I might have lost maybe like 100, 150 episodes kind of near the end there. But that's fine. Whatever. You know, archives are old archives and they go away sometimes. The format here that we are going to employ, I'm referring to 21 questions. And yes, of course, we're basing it off of the 50 Cent song. Shout out 50 Cent. Shout out Megan Good. Everyone remembers that video. If you are, what, between 25 and 35? Is that age right, Danny?
I mean, I'm 36, but sure.
Yeah, like, I'll throw it up to 40. Like, everyone remembers 21 Questions video. It's like, you know, one of the most important videos I can remember in my childhood, for sure. So we're going to run through 21 questions. We're going to put a 3-minute stopwatch on the clock here. And I am going to just ask Danny 21 questions about the NBA. Danny's going to answer. We'll have a little bit of a back and forth if we've got time. And then we're going to move on to the next question. So, Danny, are you ready to go? Or are you excited to jump into this?
I am. I will note at the outset that I'm going to focus heavily on the games that I've watched. So you might say, hey, what about Miami? They crushed Milwaukee. I didn't watch that game. That wasn't one of the ones. So I'm going to focus on that. Though I will mention some stuff if I can, that if there's context that is useful.
Yeah, like the fifth question here is about Milwaukee, and I have only watched their first game. I also did not watch the Miami game. I bet on Miami in that game, very happily.
But, congratulations, I believe.
Yeah, but it was just like as soon as Drew was out and they were missing Portis still, and then Brooke ended up missing that game as well. It was like, oh, so they're going to be missing everyone, and it's a revenge game. Yeah, let's ride here. So yeah, we're going to talk about the games we've seen for the most part. Danny and I obviously watch a lot of basketball. Like, I've been three screening the first few days of the season. I'd imagine you're doing the same, especially on the opening night where all of the teams played, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, Nate and I did the broadcast, so I focused on a couple. I've actually been watching more after-the-fact full games this year, so I actually have some more. It's been fun to do that a little bit, just because I want to get a full sense of teams, and then just using the extra time during the day to do it that way. But, you know, I've watched a lot already.
Okay, so let's dive in. I'm going to start the stopwatch, and we're going to start with question one. Danny, what team most surprised you positively in their opener?
So I would say I would give an honorable mention, very honorable, to the Atlanta Hawks. I thought they looked great. They did nothing really wrong. I just already thought they were good. And the most positive surprise for me was the Minnesota Timberwolves. Nate and I did their game against the Houston Rockets, and maybe it's that the Rockets will make everybody look good, but McDaniels and Okogie were super disruptive defensively. They played with more spirit than I had seen before, and kind of everything worked. So I'm not saying they're a playoff team, but this was the best top-to-bottom performance I have seen from Minnesota in years.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought up the defense with Minnesota, because they looked like a different team defensively in a positive way. I also thought Anthony Edwards was very aggressive and very active on defense, and we're going to talk about Edwards in a little bit here. But he was actually like really aggressive. And that's something that he's mentioned a lot in the preseason, is that his goal is to really become like a high level defender. He feels the offense is there, but he knows he has the tools to be a high level defender and wasn't all that great as a defender as a rookie, as many rookies are. So I'm intrigued with what I saw from Minnesota. I do think that first game, I'm going to be honest with you, I think that was more Houston being terrible. But I'm on record thinking Houston's going to be absolutely terrible this year. Like, I just saw nothing from their young players that says that those guys are ready to actually win games when it matters. Even, like, win games when it doesn't matter at the NBA level.
Yeah, and with Edwards, there are a couple of different thresholds that matter for players defensively, but one of them is not being the point of failure, and he was that actually more often than I think some would care to admit last year. He was not that at all in game one, and I thought that he wasn't getting beat for back cuts, he wasn't falling asleep nearly as much, and you could think of it as a small step of not being the point of failure, but it's actually a massive one for the viability of a team defensively.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up that too, because it just the thing that I think has held back Karl Towns often on that end is that he is a lot of the time the point of failure, rotating on the backside from help. But I thought he was pretty good in the game against Houston. They do have some dangerous offensive creators at the very least. I want to see how this team looks. Like, I'm pleasantly very optimistic about the Timberwolves. I took their over in the preseason. I didn't bet it, but when I did the over-under podcast with Robbie Calland, I thought that this team was poised probably to win more games than what they were projected.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
Okay. Man, we did well there. 2 minutes, 50 seconds on the dot. Question number two. What team disappointed you most in their opener?
Yeah, I think part of it is also, you know, I watched a lot of games after the fact, so you generally, those end up being closer, you know, like the Indy Charlotte game, for example. But of the ones that I focused on, the Dallas Mavericks, I think, are pretty clear. And part of it tying in with, Nate and I talk about this a lot, is it's always more concerning and more affirming when the thing that went right or wrong ties in with what you previously thought. And the worry, Jason Kidd was to me the worst coach in the NBA when the Bucks fired him, and the idea was that part of it was that he didn't tailor his approach to his personnel and that it was antiquated and it hurt his team. And I thought that Dallas's offense and their defense looked materially worse. Some of that was due to personnel, and they weren't like 100% full strength and everything like that, but they were close enough, and they were playing a very good team, but not like the 2016-17 Warriors, where it's like, oh, no matter what you do, you're going to look bad. So they were my number one.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, look, like, I went on a Twitter like thread storm about watching that Mavericks game, and it was horrible. Like, Mavericks fans have shared a shit ton of the numbers that I have tweeted. Like, that thing has like 800 likes right now, the thread that I posted. They took, I want to say it was 20 mid-range shots in that game. Last year, they took 11.8 per game. They posted up Dorian Finney-Smith, I think, three times in that game. He had two post-ups the entire season last year in 60 games. I think they took 31 non-shots at the rim or threes. Last year, they took 22, and then I actually had last year they took 25.8 of those shots. But the thing is that they played slower in that game against the Hawks. And in terms of, I had an analytics professional in the NBA actually reach out to me because he saw the thread that I was posting about the Mavericks. He said basically that if you combine long twos and long paint shots, so the shots I'm referring to, they shot 33% of their shots from the non-restricted paint area and from the mid-range, which is the highest number essentially of the Luka Doncic era. And that happened in game one. Like, that's just absolutely crazy. They had 10 post-ups through three quarters. Last year they averaged 7. All of the numbers there are just bad, it feels like, for Dallas.
Yeah, no, I don't really have anything to add. I'm just wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, like, I'm just very disappointed in this is purely a Jason Kidd problem, and let's transition to the next question here. I had a what the fuck is this Mavericks offense question, but I'll transition it to what the fuck were the Mavericks thinking hiring Jason Kidd? Like, this is absolutely insane to me to hire this guy to run your team whenever you're downgrading from Rick Carlisle, who was a spacing and efficiency savant, and you're going to Jason Kidd, who has in one game made the Dallas Mavericks offense like look wholly unwatchable.
To an extent, it reminds me of a, and I think sometimes this is overstated, there's this thing that runs around sometimes of a team drafts a college player who doesn't look like they're going to translate. And one of the reasons, like, I think of Jimmer Fredette this way, this was some of the reporting that was out there at the time of, oh, he's going to sell tickets. And my answer is always, you know what sells tickets? Good players winning games. And Jason Kidd is, and so, you know, like, Carmelo Anthony didn't sell tickets in the NBA because of his time at Syracuse. He sold tickets in the NBA because he became one of the, in some people's opinion, 75 best players of all time. And that sort of thing, you know, LeBron didn't play in college, not a big problem. And Kidd is a similar thing in that it seems like part of the argument that Nico Harrison and Mark Cuban used to get Kidd is that he is very popular among players, which is true. But Dallas doesn't have cap space. Dallas doesn't they have Luka, who you want to, of course, keep happy. But Kidd has been, you know, he was the worst coach in the league. And also, like, the way he went out at his last two stops is extremely notable. And then the other part about it is, I do not want to say that a coach who is bad in one stop is bad for the rest of their career. I mean, you could point to various coaches. Monty Williams is probably the best prominent recent example, yep. Though Nate McMillan is another one. That just great because call. A coach had a bad stop previously means they're a bad coach forever? Absolutely not. But it means that you should be very judicious about giving them another chance and seeing what it was. And, like, I mean, the other part of it is that the Mavericks are privy to a lot more information about what Jason Kidd feels. Like, what did he tell them he wanted to do with this roster? Did he say that he wanted to start Dwight Powell and Kristaps Porzingis together? Because if he did, then you shouldn't hire him.
Yeah, so that part of it's interesting too. I think that they were probably drawn to Jason Kidd's defensive teams and the success he had defensively at his stops in Brooklyn and Milwaukee.
That showed in Dallas's point of attack defense against the Hawks, which was, oh wait, that's right, terrible.
It was real bad. It was real bad. Look, Jason Kidd's not a good NBA coach. Like, it just kind of is what it is. I understand wanting to change Luka Doncic on some level, but changing Luka Doncic into a guy who runs, like, playing off ball, like, half the time and running side pick and rolls as opposed to, like, middle ball screens, like... what are we doing here?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I guess I did, but the other part of that is, if you're going to think about that sort of a concept, and the Golden State Warriors ran into this last year, if you're going to go to that approach, you have to have the complementary pieces that make sense. You're going to take the ball out of Luka Doncic's hands, okay, I think that's a poor decision, but who else do you have? I mean, Jalen Brunson is really the only other guy that I would trust to run in action on the entire Mavericks roster. Tim Hardaway can do some secondary stuff, but you don't have a Bogdan Bogdanovic or somebody or like a bigger guy who can do some of that stuff. So the beautiful game doesn't work as well.
Yeah, no, it really does not. Let's move on to our next question here. What player surprised you most in the opener?
That's a good one. I wasn't as familiar with Chris Duarte. I mean, I didn't get to watch film on him. And watching him the full game against the Hornets, I'm just like, oh, he's an NBA player. Like, that was, yes, he's also the age of an NBA veteran at 24, but that doesn't matter if you can play. And Duarte, his shot looked very comfortable. He looked comfortable with the ball in his hands, more of a secondary, tertiary ball handler, but take advantage of a mismatch, absolutely. And his shot looked good. He looked confident. And that is a success. Like, that, I mean, I'm not saying he's going to make, you know, I think it was like 6 of 9 on jump shots or something like that. I'm not saying he's going to be that for the rest of his career. But there is a part of this that is a version of the eye test, which is basically like, do I think this guy can play? And to say that about somebody in their first NBA game against reasonably capable opposition, huge surprise.
Yeah, no, I'm honestly not surprised at all with him. It's funny, like, I'm surprised that he, you know, averaged or scored 20 points, right? And made, I think it was like 6 threes or something. But
and it's not like they were feeding him.
Oh, no. Like, it was all within the flow of the offense. But this is just kind of who he is. Like, I thought it was the cleanest, most direct translation into someone being a high-level role player of any player I've evaluated in a long time. Like, this, people who listen to this podcast and people who listen to me and Matt Penny drone on about prospects most weeks on this show will know that, look, Chris Duarte was probably my favorite player in last year's draft class. Like, just straight up, I loved everything that dude stood for. He is like elite of the elite in terms of character. When you talk to people around the Oregon program and around him, like, he is a perfectly translatable game because he's defensively responsible and was somewhat disruptive in college while also being an elite shooter off of movement. He can occasionally knock down pull-ups, but he's much better just like as a relocation pull-up shooter. But that's fine. Like, that's all he needs to be at the NBA level. Yeah, Chris Duarte is a, to me, look, like, I guess there is no such thing as a no-brainer in the NBA. Like, Corey Kispert, I thought would be okay to play immediately, and he just was not. Like, you looked in the preseason, he was not ready to play. But Duarte, I thought even more so than Kispert, was ready to play. And because of that attention to detail defensively, I thought that I thought he would play. I didn't know if he'd start immediately and play real minutes, but I thought he was ready to play for sure. Let's go to number 5. Is this the most wide open you can remember a preseason title race? Like, that's kind of what I'm thinking the more that I watch the NBA right now. Like, I know that the Nets are the betting market favorites, like, in a substantial way, even without Kyrie, but I don't know if they really are the enormous favorites without Kyrie. And then the Lakers clearly are going to have at least some adjustment time, I think, to figure out how to play with Russell Westbrook and LeBron and Anthony Davis all together. And Denver is without Jamal Murray. The Suns just might not quite be ready for an NBA title, although they would be one of my favorites to come out of the West. The Utah Jazz still have playoff questions. Is this the most wide open you can remember a preseason title race?
Yes. Do you want another 2 minutes and 59 seconds? But it is. And I think that part of the reason is that the teams that I would have normally trusted the most have really big questions. And so that would be like, so in the East, Brooklyn, it's what is Kyrie, or if they theoretically traded him, a replacement or anything else like that. Like, I think the Nets are the most likely champion right now, but part of that is accounting for the possibility that Kyrie comes back. If you told me, put it in writing, he is both on the Nets and doesn't play at all this year, I probably wouldn't have them as the favorites. I just think there's a possibility. But you can also say the Clippers. I mean, I think that their roster is really strong, and I think Ty Lue's a very good coach, but Kawhi Leonard is a huge question mark. Jamal Murray's a huge question mark. I'm less sold on the Lakers as a playoff team this year than I was last year, because I think they made their roster less dynamic and less defensively versatile and less offensively versatile. And there are a lot of other teams that are very strong, the Suns, the Bucks included. But am I sold that they are absolutely, you know, like, obvious title favorites? No. So I think this is the most wide open it's been, especially also because there are teams more towards the fringe that I think, if they show some stuff, they could become plausible. I'm not going to say they probably become favorites, but they could become plausible.
Yeah, and we can transition to one of those teams now with the next question. I mean, look, we definitely trust Stephen Curry. We definitely trust Draymond Green, that those guys are 16-game players. Have the first couple of games given you a little bit more confidence that the Warriors have improved their depth enough to where they can actually be in the title race?
Oof. My general threshold for title team, for title contenders, not necessarily favorites, is elite on one end and good enough on the other. And so what that means is basically, and so a lot of times actually in modern vintage, this has been elite defensively and good enough offensively. That's what the Bucks were. That's what the Toronto Raptors were. I would argue that's what the Lakers were. And for the Warriors, the theory would have to be the other way, that they're elite offensively and that they're good enough defensively. The elite on offense when Steph Curry's on the floor, sure. I'm still very concerned, as I have been for the entire Stephen Curry era, that their offense when he's off the floor is going to be a big problem. I mean, I think they'll be better once Klay gets back, but do that. Defense, I thought they were terrible overall on Thursday night. I thought that their defense was bad. You know, their offense was mostly fine, but the defense was bad. And getting Klay Thompson back will help. Getting James Wiseman back will probably hurt. So the question is basically, do they have enough to, like, in their best lineups to stop teams? And I would say, I'll say a very tentative yes, but it's very tentative.
So why do you worry about the Warriors' defense, knowing that their defense, once they got like a fully healthy Draymond Green last year, was a top five defense in the NBA? Like, they were excellent last year defensively, I thought.
That's a fair question, but my instinct is that Klay, when he comes back, is going to be more of a wing defender, you know, a 2-3, than the 1-2 he was. And Klay was a very important point of attack defender for the Warriors. And the bigger part of that, in some ways, is that if he can't be that, the Warriors don't really have a sufficient replacement. They, you know, it's just Steph Curry, you don't want to ask him to do that because it's burning the candle at both ends. And B, he's not particularly good at that. And so I think that the help stuff will probably be fine, and they have enough on the wing, especially now that Wiggins has improved. But if I'm going to, you know, am I going to bet the farm that in key moments against, you know, the top four teams in the league that they can do it? I'm going to be queasy the whole way through.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, let's go to number seven here. If Giannis learned how to shoot pull-ups like he showed confidence with in the opener, how drastically do you think that alters the MVP conversation and the best player in the world conversation?
If it holds, it'd be huge. I mean, Giannis, to me, not only is he one of the most valuable regular season defensive players, he proved in the 2021 playoffs that he's one of the most valuable playoff defenders in the league. And so the difference between, you know, his value is different than somebody like LeBron or somebody like Durant, because he is less talented offensively than those gentlemen are. But it makes Giannis an easier cog to fit in offensively. It makes him, I mean, he's already brutally hard to defend. And it's not about making all of those shots. It's about being comfortable taking them within the flow and taking away some of the ways the teams want to defend him. So I think it would be massive.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that if he actually is shooting like pull-up jumpers comfortably, I think he's almost pretty clearly the best player in the world, right? Like, it's I guess that he's never going to be the shot creator that Kevin Durant is going to be, because Kevin Durant is just one of the five best shot creators of all time in terms of being able to get to his shot, get to his spots, and make shots efficiently from all three levels wherever he wants to, whenever he wants to. But you take into account the fact that Giannis is just such a force in transition and creates points that way. You take into account that he is genuinely one of the, I would say, five best defenders in the NBA. And this isn't to say that Kevin Durant is a bad defender. But I think those are the two guys right now that I would have, along with LeBron James just right beneath them. And the fact that LeBron James is as old as he is and is still like worthy of discussion within this conversation, or at least mention, is insane and incredible, right? But I really think that if he is knocking down pull-up jumpers in the way that he showed confidence in, like if the confidence matches the results by the end of the year, I do think that he's probably the best player on planet Earth, right? Because this is what we've just been waiting for.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
Okay, let's take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to go to the next set of seven. Okay, we're back. Number eight, this is a question that we kind of teased a little bit on your podcast when we recorded earlier this week for Real GM Radio. Did the Suns make the right or wrong call not extending DeAndre Ayton?
Oh boy. I mean, you can make an argument. I mean, I think one of the strongest ones in terms of being the wrong call is just, you know, making frustrating people involved and the fact that you want him in your organization long term. But I'm going to go correct call. And the reason why is I've been pretty consistent on this over the years that players who are not in that like first and second team all-NBA conversation or that you think have a reasonable path to getting there, like those are the no-brainer. You don't piss them off. They're going to get the max anyway, like the Lucas and the Trays of the world. I have felt over the years that teams are too willing to give, even if it's the 25% max, just a year early to players that are below that threshold. And I think Ayton is. And he had a really nice year. He had a really nice playoffs. But the idea that basically, like, how much do you have to game plan for him where he is the Xth best player on a really good team? I think the answer to that is probably third. And third is, I mean, that's great. Like, the third best player on a title team is a real success. And if that gets up to second, then you really have something cooking. But generally speaking, to me, you can wait it out a little bit on those guys. I don't love the process from what has been reported, including by our colleague Sam Amick, about how the Suns got to that point. But it, in terms of that decision, I'm broadly on board.
So I think that it's reasonable to say that he is not yet a max player. The problem is that they don't really have a function now because of the Bridges and Shamet deals to open cap space next year and like really have flexibility. So in some ways, the next few years at least, the cap space, like you just have no better way to use the money. On top of that, sure, this new TV money is coming in 2025, and we assume it's going to take effect for the 2025-26 year. And if I'm DeAndre Ayton's representatives, I am just saying, look, someone give me an offer sheet. We'll try and force them to you guys. Ultimately, Phoenix can match and we'll be stuck there for 3 years, but we're going to make it as miserable as possible for Phoenix to match this offer sheet. We're going to go player option after 3 years. We're going to go, half the money up front. We're going to go and just add all of the max trade kickers that you can and make life as miserable as possible for Phoenix to match this offer sheet. Robert Sarver is not necessarily the most consistent owner in terms of willingness to pay. I feel like there's a real chance now that the Suns are going to lose DeAndre Ayton after 2025, when in reality, they probably could have waited and ended up not losing him until after 2027. And that feels like a problem to me. Like, I think that DeAndre Ayton's a really valuable piece when it comes to the playoffs, not because of his ability to, create shots or anything, but it's just hard to find centers that can stay on the floor in terms of perimeter defense and actually move their feet while also providing real rim protection.
Yeah, I think all that's fair. One note that I'll make is that the Suns, if they want to, in their back pocket, they can do that maximum qualifying offer. We haven't seen it much in recent vintage because most of these deals just get done. But the benefit that Phoenix has there is that they can see how this year goes. And Ayton has been, I was going to say he's been pretty durable, but he did have a suspension, which was PED related. Right. So that's how we're going to count that as a little bit different. And so, I think having that year of information, it's very likely in a lot of these circumstances that the player is just going to get the max contract and so be it. And you have some hard feelings, but it's a long time until they can get their freedom. But it is, but as I said, like, and you got into this, the process here is a little bit weird, especially with the TV money coming in.
Okay, let's go to number 9. Is Anthony Edwards the most fun player in the NBA for you right now?
I enjoy Edwards a lot, but it would take a lot of growth for him this year to pass Ja Morant. I mean, I don't know how much of Memphis Cleveland you watched, but Ja
all
had
of it,
a
baby.
Block. He had a block on Lauri Markkanen at the end of the first half that was astonishing. Like, he basically got to the top of the he got to the top of the box to block a 7-footer, and he also, of course, had an alley-oop catch a dunk where he caught the ball behind him. I think it was a pass from Desmond Bane and dunked it. And Ja, sort of tying in with the old stuff about why small guys win the dunk contest, because it's more impressive when they do stuff. It's like the way he pops off the floor just defies imagination sometimes. And yeah. he's been a league pass, you know, as Nate and I've done the NBA cast, he's been a favorite of ours for years. And the other to me serious competitor, and it's just a very different type of thing, is Steph Curry. And I mean, I've spent, you know, yeah. I've seen more Steph Curry games than anybody else, I believe, in my professional career in person. And there's not much better than that. And I was in the building for his 25-point first quarter on Thursday night.
Yeah, look, I think Steph would be my pick for this because there's just nothing like it. Isn't there? Like, there's just literally nothing like watching Stephen Curry get hot. I was explaining this to Laura, my wife. We were getting back from dinner last night, and she's kind of asked how my work day was. And I was just, like, regaling her about Stephen Curry at that point. I was just like, I will never watch someone where that specific type of energy is real every time you watch him, where you just feel this like this buzz every single time he touches the ball. But all of this like conversation about fun is aesthetic, right? Like, I'll say this, I don't think anyone is as fun to watch, like, in terms of reacting to things that happen on the court as Anthony Edwards is. Like, him hitting that three against the Rockets and then looking at Steven Silas and going, "You need to call a timeout."
It was fantastic.
That shit had me cackling. Like, I didn't get to watch you and Nate do that game because I watched that game way after on Synergy. But, like, did you guys notice that in real time?
We didn't. I think we were. That was a point when the game was getting out of hand, I think, and they did call a timeout, so we started getting into all that. I wish I had caught it, but yeah, it was fantastic.
Oh my god, Anthony Edwards, in terms of just like pure like reactions and just like the funny stuff that he's going to do on the court. Maybe Anthony Edwards is the funniest NBA player right now to watch, as opposed to the most fun. But
yeah, I miss Tim Duncan's reactions to fouls, by the way. That was one of my all-timer, like, yeah. Just like, keep an eye out for this.
Oh man, let's go to number 10 here. I'll rephrase this question after originally it was just like, how much do you think Joel Embiid wants to punch Ben Simmons, like, as he goes through practice and is a dickhead? But like, it seems like, given Shams Charania is reporting today, that some bridges have been mended and Ben Simmons met with the team, and there seems to be, given Tobias Harris's tweet, saying that they'll respect his privacy and space during this time. When he's ready, we will embrace our brother with love and handle our business on the court. That's it. That's all. It seems like they've come to something of a mutual understanding-ish. But just like, how frustrated are the vets on this team with Ben Simmons? And I mean, like, we don't think this is coming to an end anytime soon, do we?
Oh, no, I think this is going to be a long haul for a bunch of different reasons. But I think that the Simmons frustration, I think, goes in a couple of different angles. And I think the one that shouldn't be lost in the shuffle, and I don't want to make, you know, and part of why I want to focus on this is that it is very possible that Simmons is dealing with mental health stuff right now, and I want to acknowledge the potential validity of that, is that over the years, Ben Simmons, a prodigious natural talent, and this goes back to our mutual friend Jonathan Givony's piece that he retweeted recently of going back to 2016 about, you know, the idea of, you know, Simmons' mentality. And Ben Simmons has been naturally talented the whole time I've been following him, and you followed him longer than I have. But he's also had identifiable weaknesses. And it is possible that those are so intractable that if he put infinite time in, he just can't solve it. But generally speaking, somebody who has the physical gifts that Ben Simmons does, if they work on their shot, if they work on some of these stuff, it's going to get better. And so, yeah, him not being present right now is something, but Simmons, if he had, over the years, before all of this current stuff, if he had taken those steps, if he had grown his game, even modestly, the Sixers would be so good that none of this tension would exist.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Like, at the end of the day, it comes down to Ben not having taken strides in his game, and that's where all of this starts. It all begins with the fact that Ben Simmons has never learned to shoot and has essentially lost confidence, it feels like, because teams have figured out how to defend him because he's never like improved upon the specific skills that he needs to improve upon. So yeah, it's frustrating. I don't know that we need to like say a ton more about that. I feel like everyone is doing the Ben Simmons takes. So let's move forward. The Kings were really fun on, what was that? It was Wednesday. I guess it was in the United States. They beat the Portland Trailblazers by 2 in a really tight game that was strangely officiated down the stretch, let's go with.
Well, and at times strangely played down the stretch.
And at times strangely played. I think that my pick for first time All-Star this year in the West, because every year we get like one or two, right? I think that De'Aaron Fox is going to get a wild card slot on the All-Star team in the West. Are you as high as Fox or as high on Fox as I am?
I don't think so. I like Fox a lot, but to me, I think Ja Morant, as the most important thing that point guards can do is create shots for themselves and others, and I think Morant has taken another step forward. And so I think both of them have taken steps forward, so Morant was already there, to quote the great Pierce Hawthorne. I think he was already streets ahead. So I think that I will put Ja in front in that conversation, but it's, you know, I think that Fox is worthy of consideration, and it is true, I mean, because we always think about these things in more static terms, that for years, the West guard, you know, getting into the West All-Star guard conversation has been so brutal, but James Harden's in the East now. And that makes it a little bit easier. And I try not to do the, oh, well, like Russell Westbrook's super popular and he's in the Western Conference. It's more like, will you be among the five best guards in the West? And so if I had to make a pick of a new West guard, I also can't remember whether Donovan Mitchell's made it before. I think he has.
He has. Yeah, he made it last year.
So then he wouldn't qualify. But so I'm going to go Ja over Fox off the cuff.
So here'd be my case for De'Aaron, and he looks so much stronger this year. Like, he looks way more physically powerful. And I have some questions about the three-point jumper, but, I mean, he was pulling with confidence in that game against the Blazers. Like, he took 8 threes in that game. I don't know the exact numbers on De'Aaron in terms of, like, how many times he's taken 8 threes in a game. I cannot imagine it's been often, can you?
I don't think it's been very much.
Like, he took 13 in a game against the Pelicans last year. He took 8 in 10 games last year, just kind of looking through the numbers here. But it felt different to me, I guess. Like, it just felt much different in terms of, this is a guy that looks like he is totally in control of what he's doing at all times, and that feels like something that definitely wasn't true whenever he was younger, and it feels like something that's going to be translatable to the Kings hopefully being pretty competitive this year. I mean, I had some questions about the Kings coming into the year, but if De'Aaron is going to do this, and his synergy with Rashawn Holmes is really strong. I thought Rashawn Holmes was really, really good in that game against the Blazers. I don't know. I think that De'Aaron Fox is probably going to average 26 points, 7 assists, and once you start getting into that range, you're in All-Star numbers range at least. Let's go to question 12. We kind of mentioned them a little bit earlier when talking about Dallas, but I think I was blown away by Atlanta in that game against Dallas on Thursday night. Do you think there's a more modernly built team than the Hawks right now? And the reason I say that is that they have multiple bigs that they can play and protect the rim. They have a lot of switchable defenders. They have elite level shooting, and they have a monster point guard who can take on high level usage at all times. It feels like Atlanta, just in terms of team building, not necessarily in terms of talent, it feels like Atlanta has really figured out the way to construct a roster in the modern NBA.
I love their offensive versatility and the idea that just because you have a heliocentric player, this ties in with the criticism I had of the Mavericks earlier, just because you have a heliocentric player doesn't mean you want them to be the only guy who can handle the ball. So having Bogdanovich out there, at times Gallinari, we'll see what kind of growth and comfort Cam Reddish and DeAndre Hunter have this year. That makes things a lot easier. And John Collins, I mean, he had a beautiful alley-oop to Capella in that game against the Mavs. But my answer, which surprised myself, like we talked about these questions a little bit ahead of time, is actually the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, and that's a good, answer.
The Celtics have two different things that I think the Hawks do not. Not that I'm saying they're a significantly better team or anything like that. One is, I think their roster is more overall defensively versatile. I mean, Robert Williams, his switching stuff is really interesting. But also, they can play smaller. They don't have that really, like, the Draymond Green-esque, I mean, unless you think Grant Williams can be that guy, like, switchy five. But I think Robert Williams might end up being that guy. But then the other thing that I find so tantalizing about the Celtics, and is, I would argue is a more modern thing that, as we move into the league, could become there, is that they have a bunch of guys that are similar levels of quality. And what that brings, should Ime Udoka approach it this way, is that he doesn't have to close with the same five every time, and that there will be nights when Dennis Schroeder makes sense. There will be nights that Dennis Schroeder does not make sense. There will be nights that Robert Williams should be out there and everything else. And so I think that also their multitude of wings and wing-sized guys is thoroughly modern. I mean, the idea of Tatum and Brown and Marcus Smart and potentially Aaron Nesmith, if he can put it together a little bit, and we'll see with Romeo Langford and all that. And even some of their non-wings kind of in some ways have wingy elements is really intriguing. So I'm going to go with the Celtics.
Speaking of the Celtics, a question that I had scheduled for later, but let's just kind of transition to it now. I mean, I think Robert Williams looks like a monster for the Celtics. I thought that he looked great in that double overtime game. He played 44 minutes in that game. It was the second game he's ever played over 30 minutes over 30 minutes in his career. And I'm blown away by his versatility and his defensive ability as a switch defender even, and his rim protection and his passing. Like, it feels like he really might end up being like a top 10 center in the NBA. So he signed a 4-year, $55 million deal in the offseason. And it's a deal that I think he kind of had to sign, just given that he's been so non-durable throughout the course of his career to this point. But do we think there's a real chance that we look back on that deal and we're like, oh, this was a great deal for Boston to get done as quickly as they did in the offseason, even before like the traditional October extension season started?
There is absolutely a chance, and I would have to really think about it. So, I mean, I would put Bam in a different conversation because he's established a different level of quality than a lot of these other young guys. But if we're going to throw some of the other young bigs kind of in a path with Ayton and Jared Allen, who got a lot of money, and Robert Williams, and various other players. Like, and now Towns is 26, so he's not in this. He's a little bit too old for this now. And you could, if you wanted to put Miles Turner, I think you probably could. I think there's a meaningful chance that Robert Williams ends up being the most dominant of those players. That he, it could be a lot of them, but I like Robert Williams more than Jared Allen. If he can stay on the floor, I think that his defense, he has more, he can do more things defensively, I think, than Jared Allen. I've been banging the Jared Allen drum for 4 years now. Like, this is not a I hate Jared Allen segment. And Robert Williams, he pops a little bit differently offensively. And it's funny to say that after Allen went 11 for 11 from the field in a game that the team played three bigs. But I think that, and I'm saying there's a chance for Williams. I'm not saying it's definite, especially when you consider what Ayton did in the playoffs. But his ceiling is the roof.
It really is. It is very, very impressive. And every time I watch Robert Williams, like, just because I have these preconceived notions sometimes of guys, and I'm really good at, you know, changing my opinions of players based on new information. But I just have these visions in my brain of Robert Williams being like a very simple player at Texas A&M. He didn't show any of the passing stuff that he has shown with Boston. I'm just staggered every time he makes, like, he's out on the perimeter, he short rolls, and then he makes like this crazy, like, overhead looping whip pass to the corner. And I'm like, wait, where did this come from? Like, every time Robert Williams is on the court, I really just, like, I learn new things about him, and I'm just like, this is very, very impressive. So I think it's probably going to be a steal as long as he can stay on the court. That's always come down to, can he stay on the court?
Yeah, one of the differences between Williams and Jared Allen is that Robert Williams just tries shit, and there's an interesting, I don't have the data strong enough in my head, But there's this thing that when young players, when they turn the ball over, it can actually be an indicator, a positive indicator, with the idea that some of the things that they're doing are indicators of ambition and intention. And sometimes that leads to bad stuff because some players just make bad passes. But, like, for example, Trae Young, and I'm not comparing Robert Williams to Trae Young as a passer, but the idea that he's thinking about things that other guys aren't necessarily, if you can hone it, if you can sand down the edges, that can actually be really useful for you. And you brought up the short roll. That's one of the most encouraging things about Robert.
So let's go to a question that I had scheduled for a little bit later, but we can move to it now, is how long does this three big experiment last for the Cavaliers? Because, oh boy, was that a disaster. I know that there have been some numbers shared online about, like, yeah, the starters, they were fine. They only gave up 91 points per 100 possessions in 10 minutes. I mean, you watch the tape. It was ugly. And look, like, not every team is going to have Ja Morant. And Ja Morant is a specifically bad player to play a three big lineup against because of his speed, both out in transition and in the half court. But man, that looked ugly when I watched that Cavs game. And it's funny because I didn't even feel like their players played bad. Like, I felt like they actually played pretty well in that game, especially offensively. But how long does this three big experiment last for the Cavs?
I think it's going to last a while. And the challenge for JB Bickerstaff is that you have to replace one of them with somebody who's playing better or who makes more sense. And Isaac Okoro is the most natural one there, but the problem is I think Okoro's best defending guards. And I think he's actually very good at it. He had some really nice performances last year. But let's say you're going to do that. Then Isaac Okoro is largely going to be, if you want him guarding the other team's best ball handler, then what are you doing with Garland and Sexton? So you run into those sorts of problems. And Okoro, not a reliable shooter, so then playing him with Mobley, who showed a little bit, and Allen, who a talented player but just doesn't really space the floor that much, that gets into challenge. The other one would be go to somebody like Jetty Osman, but Osman doesn't have the equity with the franchise that Markkanen does. They just gave up stuff to acquire him. He paid him a bunch of money. And while Osman is also paid a bunch of money, it's a different sort of deal. So I think this is going to be the approach for a while. I don't think it's going to be the only thing they do, but I think it's going to be the primary thing for, I would say, a significant portion of this year.
Here's the thing that frustrated me with it, and I'll talk positively about Evan Mobley here in a second, but, like, I don't think Jarrett Allen is strong enough as a rotational defender consistently to be the guy that, like, is your true anchor who's paid, like, a crazy amount of money defensively. And the Grizzlies shot, like, 67 to 70% at the rim. I can't remember the exact number, but, like, they shot a high percentage at the rim despite the fact that they had three bigs on the court for most of the game. And part of that is, look, teams are going to be able to get out and transition against the Cavs, and they're going to create easier baskets at the rim, but, like, even in the half court, like, it just seemed like Ja Morant was beating them to the spot, beating them to their rotation so often that it was frustrating. And he got the switch out on Lauri Markkanen so often. And that's what I worry, is just that it's going to be too hard for them to stay in front of teams and to consistently rotate. Having said that, Evan Mobley looked phenomenal. He looked good, every bit like what we were hoping that he would look like, and he might just be the glue that can kind of hold it together well enough. But I think teams are just going to attack Lauri Markkanen in space way too often, and it's going to be a problem for them. Let's take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to get to something else that I saw in that Grizzlies-Cavs game. Okay. Desmond Bane showed a ton of just straight line driving and attacking, just a lot of ability to not just be a pure floor spacer in that game against the Cavs, I thought. Now, part of that is that he was going up against a third big often, right? But are we a Desmond Bane buyer to be more than just a floor spacer? Because I think I'm at the point where I am.
I was impressed. And you don't need a second player to do everything. I mean, unless you're going to... The idea is that Bane can run the show when Moraine is out. I don't think he's at that level yet. But the ability to push the advantage, to create a new advantage, was new for me with Bane. I thought that, as you said, he attacked way better towards the basket. And also, he made good decisions once he got there, which is an underrated part of that. It's not just getting there, it's doing something smart when you do. And so, yeah, I think the in-between game, the connective tissue for Desmond Bane is better than I saw last year, and that's immensely encouraging.
Yeah, no, I really agree. And him taking on some secondary creation stuff, I feel like that really is what they need. Like, they need a guy that can just make some plays happen. Look, like, I don't think he's necessarily going to be some real shot creator, but if he can just, like, take advantage of the opportunities that are given to him, that, you know, someone closes out on him so heavy because of the threat of his jumper, because he is a legit 40% three-point shooter. I don't know. Like, I feel like that actually does really change what Memphis can do, because they can then, like, get teams further into rotation because he can pass a little bit. I'm a fan of Desmond Bane. I think he's, like, a real building block for Memphis and not just a, like, role player or rotation player. Like, I'm not saying he's going to be an all-star, but I think that, like, he's probably a nine-figure player throughout the course of his career.
Yeah, very well could be.
Okay, let's go to number 16 here. Can Eric Bledsoe sustain in a Bruce Brown-like role for the Clippers this year? So Bruce Brown last year for the Nets played almost as a small ball big man. They came up, he set screens, he short rolled, and made plays from within. That's really how the Clippers used him against Golden State, or used Eric Bledsoe against Golden State in their game on Thursday night. And it was really impressive to me that they decided to utilize Bledsoe that way. I thought it was a really creative idea. How do we think Bledsoe is going to operate within this construct going forward?
It was a wrinkle I did not expect to see. And the Warriors clearly did not expect to see it, because they had... basically no capacity to defend it. And some of that is it's hard, it's challenging. And the Clippers, when Eric Bledsoe is your worst shooter, and there were some of their lineups where they kind of went in that direction, you're going to be hard to defend almost no matter what. And I think that these stout guys can actually be very useful in an offense in that form. Brown is too, and I brought up Eric Gordon when Ken Pelton was tweeting about this on Thursday. And so I think that there is a place for Bledsoe, and that incidentally will only theoretically enhance once you get Kawhi Leonard back, because that's another really good player who could space the floor. Now, part of what makes the Clippers interesting is that when Serge Ibaka, if and when Serge Ibaka is healthy, they have somebody who can do that and also defend, you know, defend, protect the rim and everything else. So I think there is a place for it, and I think Bledsoe is now... I'm thinking of his place as being more viable for them than I did previously, and maybe that was also a reminder that the New Orleans situation last year was a tire fire, and maybe he identified that and didn't have his best season. But yeah, I think there's a place for him.
I just kind of think we throw away that New Orleans year for Bledsoe. I'm not saying he's going to be as good as he was on Thursday night every night, but that New Orleans situation just seemed like a total disaster, and it seemed like he was not necessarily up to his highest level. Let's go with. So, yeah, if they're going to use him creatively in a way that actually suits his skills, I'm optimistic about Bledsoe this year. But let's go to the next question here. We can kind of buzz through these last few. The Spurs were really fun against the Magic. I'm not sure how much of that game that you ended up watching, but they were... look, part of this is the Magic were awful. I'm willing to at least give them some time, I guess, just because they were without all of Jonathan Isaac and Markelle Fultz, and Gary Harris was a late scratch, and Chuma Okeke isn't playing. Like, that's potentially three or four of their starters, I guess, but like, they just weren't running anything. Like, they were running the most bland, like, non-creative offense. And that actually does give me some real worry throughout the course of the season. The Magic just might be really bad. But let's talk about the positive here. The Spurs were really fun. Who's your favorite young guy on the Spurs? Your favorite, between DeJounte Murray, Derek White, Lonnie Walker, Devin Vassell, Keldon Johnson, Josh Primo. Who's the guy that stood out to you most?
Keldon Johnson. Part of why I like Keldon so much is that as a forward size guy who's a capable defender, he's more plug and play. And I mean, the value of wings around the league is sky high. And we know Johnson works hard. That's part of why he got moved up from the select team to actually make the Olympic team. I didn't get to watch much of that game, and I've been intrigued by Devin Vassell before, so I wouldn't be stunned if by the end of the year it was Vassell. And Derek White, before the weird lost year that he had, he was intriguing as well as somebody who could defend multiple positions and can shoot and can kind of fit in as a primary or a secondary ball handler. But I like Keldon Johnson the best.
I think I would still lean Keldon Johnson in this for sure. I ask this question solely because I thought Devin Vassell was awesome in that game against the Magic. Everything came just so within the flow of the offense. It was so decisive. And by the way, that's also why I really like Keldon Johnson. Everything he does is just very decisive and aggressive. And he makes quick decisions with the ball whenever he has it. Like, he doesn't really fuck around with it. He just keeps that thing moving, or he's going to drive and attack. I will just say, though, Devin Vassell, like, he pulled out like a penny, like, you know, turnaround jumper that was absolutely disgusting in the mid range. And with his high release point, it was really, really difficult to contest. He was really good defensively. He's so long and so active on that end. If it turns out to be Devin Vassell, I would not be surprised. I think that I would lean Keldon Johnson just from a safety standpoint right now. Like, he's proven the most out of that group to me. DeJounte's been good, and Derek White's obviously been good. But I think Keldon probably is the safest one of the group to be a great difference-making player. But Devin Vassell looks really, really good. And if the shot creation stuff particularly holds up, he has a real shot, I think, to be something of a difference maker in the NBA. Let's go to number 18 now. Can Will Barton and his addition, which if you remember last year, he missed a big portion of the latter part of the season. He played, I think, in what, maybe four of the games in the playoff series against the Suns, but wasn't himself very clearly. Will Barton is back and is fully healthy and can stay fully healthy. Can he bring the Nuggets just enough offense to where he keeps their perimeter play afloat while Jamal Murray is out, and that they can sustain as a 50-win team?
I think he can, and part of why Barton is so important is that he, especially in the kind of the non-Jokic units, he slots everybody else into more survivable roles, because Barton can take on some of the playmaking, he can take on some of the scoring, so whether it's Facundo Campazzo or Austin Rivers or Monte Morris, depending on how they're structuring it, it just makes a lot more sense. You're putting the ball in their hands a little bit less, you're having it in Barton's hands a little bit more, and the Nuggets have a lot of other really good players, and they have some capable defensive theories, which is always useful. So I think they can be a 50-win team. You know, they can play at that sort of a level. I'm not saying it's the most likely outcome, just because injuries and like they're dancing on the knife's edge, like really, just because they already have one of their best players out, and any team would be in that circumstance, even when your number one player is the reigning MVP and an Iron Man. But there is a reasonable theory of the case, and so that's why I'll say yes.
I think that my answer is also yes. I think that Barton was so good against that Suns team on Wednesday night. I guess that game would have been. Look, I'm in Australia. The days are all off, Danny. I can't even, you know, keep track of what day it is here, let alone in the United States. His aggressiveness definitely went noticed. I feel like last year in the playoffs particularly, they were just missing that level of aggressiveness and guys that are just willing to go get it, right? Like, Monte Morris is a great player. He's a great decision maker. he is someone that I think could stand to play a bit more aggressively. It's why Austin Rivers, like, I think was actually really useful for them in the playoffs, because he was just ready to go for it, right? Like, he was out there, he would just catch the ball and he would fire. Will Barton does not have a conscience, and I think that just having that guy who doesn't have a conscience out on the perimeter is going to be huge for them, just in terms of being able to create enough offense around Nikola Jokic to where teams can't load up on Jokic and just try to make his life a living hell. It also helps to have, like, probably, let's say, at least a top three offensive player in the NBA in Jokic. He's just such a superstar that it's incredible to me. Let's go to number 19. The Pacers tossed up threes on 53% of their shots in their first game under Rick Carlisle. Yeah, they gave up the big lead to the Hornets and they lost their opener. But are you more bullish on them after that opener, just based on what seems like really strong offensive process to me, given what their roster is?
Maybe vaguely. I have been a believer in Rick Carlisle's coach for such a long time that it's not a surprise. And Nate Bjorkgren, process-wise, I thought did some very good things for the Pacers. It was just reportedly everything else that didn't go particularly well for him. And the Pacers, I thought the offense looked good, and when you consider that they were missing two vital players in TJ Warren and Caris LeVert, like, that's even more impressive, because then you can put Justin Holiday and potentially Duarte and some of these other guys in easier roles. Also, you dramatically improve your depth. So I think that the argument that there is a pretty clear-cut playoff team in Indiana if they could stay remotely healthy, I thought that before the season. I continue to think that now. So I don't think it significantly changed it, but I think more people are going to be moving my direction than I'm going to be moving.
Yeah, when I watched that game, I just felt like they were actually running sets that really made sense. Like, it was a drastically different deal than what Rick Carlisle was running in Dallas, with, you know, having Luka Doncic around and centering the sun around, like, Luka was the sun in which everything was centered around, right? They ran a lot more, you know, two-man game stuff with Malcolm Brogdon and Domantas Sabonis. I thought it was interesting that they didn't really close with Miles Turner. They closed with Sabonis, and then they played, like, Torrey Craig a reasonable amount. Last year, Domantas Sabonis only had one game where he took six threes. He took six threes in the opener. I wonder if that's going to be, like, a real change for Sabonis, because I think that he actually can shoot, like, at a pretty reasonable level to where he can be a threat. And then on top of that, I do wonder if he does become a shooter at that level, does that make Miles Turner available at a level to which we haven't seen the Pacers, like, genuinely engage on Miles Turner trades? I don't know. I'm going to be really interested, because I think you're right. I think the Pacers are going to be really good. I know that first game had to suck to watch them lose that lead in the way that they did, but
yeah, it was like a 23-2 run or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that was a LaMelo Ball, like, superstar performance, but at the end of the day, like, I'm a little bit more bullish on them after such a crippling loss than what I thought I would be, just kind of thinking through the process. And that's, I don't know, I feel like that might be weird to some people, right?
Yeah, could be.
Okay, let's go to number 20. Are the Blazers legitimately just a six deep team with Larry Nance coming off the bench and their starters? Or do we trust Anfernee Simons, Nasir Little, Tony Snell when he gets back from injury? Do we trust those guys enough to where the Blazers can have enough depth to make a legit top six playoff run?
If all you're asking those guys to do is play 10 to 20 minutes a game and be a small cog in the offensive machine and try on defense in two of the three cases, I think they could do that. I like Nasir Little. I thought he really showed some signs last year. I like Tony Snell. I don't think he's going to replicate the shooting performance that he had as an Atlanta Hawk last year, but he can be a capable 10 to 20 minute a game wing, and that means it will be a problem of scale for the Blazers whenever somebody's out, because I don't think they have a lot of suitable replacements. You know, so if Robert maybe with Covington, they could slide. They can slide Little in. He can do enough. But you know, even if it's Nurk, and I really like Larry Nance Jr., but then like, how do you fill the rest of it, and how do you do everything else? So I think the Blazers have a chance of being a top 16, but I think their offense is going to be awesome. Their defense looked abysmal yet again against the Sacramento Kings. But if they falter, I don't think depth is going to be the reason.
What do you think would be the reason if they falter?
Oh, abysmal defense. I mean, if they're a bottom five defense, then they're. I mean, and if you go back to the Terry Stotts, through this Terry Stotts era, they had an above 20th defense three times, and those three teams were very good, and every other team was inconsistent.
Yeah, I was very startled that the Chauncey Billups era did not bring any real improvement defensively. Like, they go out, they get Larry Nance, you get another year of continuity from Robert Covington, you get Yusuf Nurkic back for a full season, hopefully. If they just weren't any better. Like, that was a bad game. Maybe they'll be better, you know, coming up here in game two. But I don't know. That defense was rough. And I feel like, given that they might not have enough depth, like, they don't really have a guy coming off the bench right now other than Nance. Like, they don't have a wing or a guard that I feel like is going to change the game defensively just with, like, energy, right? Nasir Little could be that guy. And I think that, like, if he can fill that role, it would be phenomenal. But I don't think he is filling that role yet. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think he's doing it yet. Like, that's what they need. They need Tony Snell. I'm sorry. Good God. Terry Stotts, Tony Snell. They need Tony Snell to come in and really change.
I was going to say they need Terry Rozier, which would be a really good help for them.
They need Terry Rozier. Oh, God. Like, Terry Rozier, Damian Lillard, Norman Powell, CJ McCollum. Let's just go, you know, all 6'3" and under and just go nuts with, like, a bunch of scrappy, aggressive guys. Let's do it. I'm in. Okay. Number 21 and the final question, the only important question on the Game Theory podcast. Are you a believer in Pokuism, the acceptance of Alexei Pokushevsky as your basketball savior?
I like to start each year trying to find my favorite curiosity, and I will say that Poku and Pokuism have a very viable chance of being my favorite. And worth noting that many players and teams move beyond curiosity when they get to be too good. Shout out LaMelo Ball. Like, LaMelo Ball is too good to be a curiosity. Poku is a possibility. Your beloved NBA Chalamet, Josh Giddey, is also a possibility. But there are a bunch of them, and I'm not hitching my wagon to any one star yet. I just kind of need to see where the rhythm takes me. But Poku is fascinating, and I don't know if you've played it at all, but one of the most delightful things I've been fiddling a little bit with 2K this year is the Pokuism video game experience is about on brand.
Wait, really?
Which is pretty amazing. It, like, I was playing against the Thunder, and I'm like, wait, what is Poku doing? It was kind of delightful.
I might get NBA 2K just to play with Poku. Like, that might be my only...
Or honestly, to play against Poku.
You see this, like, gangly 7-footer out there flying around, chucking shots.
I did a Rockets Thunder game because one of the things I do in the early part when I'm kind of like calibrating a video game is I play teams that are, like, you know, that are similar levels of skill, and I wanted to play with Jalen Green, so I'm like, well, who's similar level to the Rockets? And I picked the Thunder, and I was just like, every once in a while, like, weird stuff would be happening on the other team, and I'd be like, oh yeah,
they have Poku. Poku is just wild. The opener was not the most exciting game for Poku. I will say that it was he was going up against a team in Utah that is actually well drilled and well schooled, and he didn't really, it seemed like, know totally what to do out there. But he had 3 assists and 2 turnovers. What a we will be doing, okay, some sort of Poku watch throughout the year on this podcast.
Sam, I have a question for you. Will either Bol Bol or Bones Highland play enough to qualify as a curiosity?
I think Bones should be in their rotation right now. Like, I don't know what Denver is doing. Like, I think that they could actually use Bones a little bit. Like, I think they could actually use him really well. So, yeah, I think Bones will play. I've never been high enough on Bol Bol to where I think that's a possibility. Like, if you want someone like Bol Bol in terms of curiosity, just go with Poku, because he's more, like, agile and more coordinated and can pass the ball in like really creative ways. He's just like a more fun version of the Bol Bol experience, I feel like.
Fair.
Danny, thank you for being the guinea pig on this episode of 21 Questions with the Game Theory Podcast. How do you think it went? We struggled to record. Like, people aren't going to hear it, but there were some stoppages there because my internet died midway through the podcast. But how do we think it went?
I think it was fun. I enjoyed basically thinking about this many things. I mean, there have only been, as we record this, three nights of games, two of which were three-game nights. I mean, one of them might even been a two-game night. But we've already learned so much, and there's still so much more to learn.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Danny, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people where they can hear those dulcet Bay Area tones.
So in terms of listening, which is where most of my work is now, you can listen to Real GM Radio. My most recent guest was the one and only Sam Vecenie, where we focused on the 2022 and 21 drafts. You can also listen to Dunked On and Dunked On Prime. You can watch the NBA cast, which is going to be Mondays on League Pass. Nate Duncan and I will do one game a week and bring in some X's and O's and answer your questions. And then my written work, when it appears, will be at The Athletic, including some collaborative pieces with Sam Vecenie.
Go subscribe to The Athletic. Go follow all of Danny's work. He does great work with Nate. He does great work on Real GM Radio. He does great work all over the internet. We will be back later this week with some more good NBA content. I'm going to try and record over the weekend with a good friend of the program. But until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.